Living in Hope was presented by Nancy Scott on February 17, 2004, at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. This is the sixth talk in part two of a series entitled Doing Christianity. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
My topic tonight is Living in Hope. The series is Doing Christianity, Having Faith, and I'm going to talk a little bit about hope. I was thinking a little bit about, I was just being thankful that that my life doesn't depend on things going smoothly, since things weren't going so smoothly about 10 minutes ago when I went out and found my car battery dead because I'd left my lights on. So, anyway, here we are. As I was preparing to give this talk, I was aware that in thinking about my own experience of hope in my Christian faith, I have had two pretty different perspectives on what that hope is and what I expect out of my faith and Christianity. So while I wanted to talk a little bit about that, I think it's also the case that I think there's some clearly stated things in Scripture about what the gospel promises and what our hope as believers is. And yet I also think that we have really differing subjective experiences of what gives us hope and what is hopeful to us. So I'm going to talk hopefully a little bit about both of those things as well and kind of see where this goes and probably leave plenty of time for discussion and thoughts. We'd love to hear your experiences too. So, so early on in my Christian life, I think that I knew that there was something about heaven going on with this Christianity that I was involved with, that heaven was kind of a big deal. But I think that I really thought, and this was, I think, what was pretty popular at that time in the early to late 70s, that really the hope of the Christian faith was to have a life that was really different than it would be without God in it. And so my hope felt more like my hope was for having a fulfilling life here. And if I could just figure out what God wanted and how to be in His will and how to walk with Him, and how to have His Spirit's power in my life, then I would live the kind of life I really wanted to live. And I would be successful. And I didn't even mean materially or anything. I meant spiritually successful. And I don't know how exactly I would have tried to define that other than that that life would be fulfilling in some way. And that... that life would be fulfilling. And part of that was I'd get to do kind of what I wanted to do. Like if I found God's will for my life, that would mean that it was like the perfect thing for me to do with my life, and life would be really great because it was designed just for me and I'd found the path and all that kind of stuff. Have you guys ever thought that way or kind of felt like maybe that was what the deal was? So there was somehow kind of a super spiritual life that I could have. And that was my hope. So as I thought about trying to understand my faith, I thought about that kind of being the carrot out there. That's what I was going after. That was what I was waiting for and hoping for. So heaven was kind of this very abstract idea to me. In fact, I can remember in the 80s a song by Talking Heads where they have a song about heaven, and the basic theme is heaven is a place where nothing ever happens. And I remember kind of thinking about it that way, like, you just go and sing and hang out with angels, and I don't know if they sounded kind of boring to me at that time, but So I just thought about heaven as something that was pretty irrelevant. So that didn't really concern me. But then a few things happened in my life that really challenged this view. One thing that happened was that I decided to become a missionary, and I was heading with Wycliffe Bible Translators to, actually came here to study for a summer, and I was planning on going to Africa and working, doing community development work and that kind of thing. And I think I really had the sense that because I was going to do that, that was kind of the, and I think our culture, the culture I was in anyway, very much supported me in this idea that going to be a missionary was like the thing to do. I mean, it was like the rightest thing you could do as a Christian. So I was on the track of doing this thing that I was talking about from earlier. And something that I think really kind of startled me happened pretty early on in that experience of the first summer that I was really doing that. I had left all my belongings and they were in storage and I was not supposed to need any of that because this was going to be so satisfying. And I can just remember an experience pretty mundanely, but of just being really homesick and really missing what I had left behind and really missing the people I had left behind and even my home, the stuff in it, you know. And I think I had this idea that wasn't supposed to happen that way because I was doing something that was so spiritual and so right. I mean, I don't think I was proud about it in a way that it might sound, but I think it kind of exposed that in me, that I think maybe I thought I wouldn't struggle like this with something like this. It would just work its way out, and I wouldn't need those things that, you know, I was giving up because it was the right thing to give up, and I don't know. Does that make sense? So that was really challenging to me. And a couple of other things happened that also raised this question for me about, it didn't seem to be mapping out the way that I thought it was going to. And so that was part of what challenged this view for me. So it raised this really big question about what exactly was the gospel promising and what could I count on for this life? And if I needed to think about the next life too, that was fine, but I hadn't really seen them as that connected at that time. So I went to the scriptures and I read over a lot of various New Testament writers and tried to understand, I wondered how they were looking at this thing, this question. And I wanted to take a few minutes and just read two or three passages that were particularly challenging to me given this mindset that I was coming at them with and all of a sudden kind of realizing that the biblical authors might have been thinking about it really pretty differently than how I was thinking about it. I'll start with 1 Peter, chapter 1, verses 6 through 9. Thank you. So 1 Peter 1, verses 6 through 9. Says, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him, and though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you rejoice, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible, and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls." And another one that challenged me was Romans chapter 5. And I think I'll read a little bit more than I typed out. Thank you very much. Romans chapter 5, verses 1 through 4 or 5, somewhere in there. "Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom also we have obtained our introduction by faith into this grace in which we stand, and we exult in hope of the glory of God. And not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance, proven character, and proven character, hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us. And then the last passage I'll read is Romans 8, verses starting with 18 and going through about 24. 25. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but also we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. For in hope we have been saved, but hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one also hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, with perseverance we wait eagerly for it. I think that these passages, among others, really struck me with the idea that the people who wrote these words, I think, were expecting something different than what I was expecting. And when I came at it with the view that I was bringing, I could see it a certain way. But then when it didn't really fit and work, I had to kind of rethink it and think about how, what if they were coming at it with a whole different mindset? Would it make more sense coming from a different, bigger picture? And the more I began to understand that believing the gospel, unlike what I had been taught and what I had believed, wasn't so much about having this kind of life here that was going to solve all my troubles, but it was actually more about solving my biggest problem, which was my heart. Oh, and I didn't read one of the other verses that really struck me. It was in Galatians chapter 5. The first part of the chapter. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. You have been severed from Christ. You who are seeking to be justified by law. You have fallen from grace. For we, through the Spirit, by faith, are waiting for the hope of righteousness. That kind of threw me too, because I think one of the things that's common in all of these passages is that these guys were not really setting their sights on what this life might look like, but rather what was coming and what they were looking forward to. And they were looking forward to a couple of different things, I think. One thing is that is righteousness, that the gospel was going to address this thing that the world is like suffering these pangs of childbirth, the creation is groaning under this curse that we all are very well aware of, and the promise of the gospel, as they understood it, was that that curse would be lifted, that we would be set free from that, and not just the creation, but our very hearts would be set free. I also began to rethink how I learned from a couple of different sources that the way Jesus was talking about the kingdom and what we've come to think about as heaven was really coming out of a very different mindset than the one that I was bringing to it. And when I started to understand that, excuse me, the biblical authors when they talk about heaven and when they talk about the kingdom, it's kind of like this place where it started to become a lot more interesting to me, because it turns out that it's this place where it might be a lot like this, only with evil gone. And I started thinking about that as an idea and what this place would be like if you got rid of evil and inside of me and outside of me. And I think I could be really interested in a place like that, in being there. That does not sound like a place where nothing ever happens. It actually sounds more like a place where things can flourish, where relationships can flourish, where life and intention and purpose can flourish, because it doesn't have this weight of this curse on it. So my hope, I think, biblically speaking, is essentially that I'm going to be fixed, that I'm going to have what's so broken inside of me made right, and that this creation is also going to be restored in some way. So that's the biblical picture. It seems to me that Peter's faith, for example, in that passage, was not really focused on, like mine had been, on what he could get in this life, even spiritually, but rather it was focused on whether his soul would be found faithful, proven and saved on the day when Jesus' kingdom would finally come. So having citizenship in this kingdom was really the thing that was to be most desired. It was the ultimately important thing. And this, I think it's this that the gospel is actually about. It's telling a story, and we're not at the end of the story yet. That end of the story is where we're heading, and because it's true, I can actually live in hope here and now, even in the midst of very difficult circumstances, mundane, sometimes boring life, sometimes really suffering and difficult life. And I think this is why for Peter, what he was saying is his suffering didn't stand in the way of that. It was like it was actually a way that his faith could be purified and be made found even more secure in that day that he was waiting for. So that was a pretty different way of thinking about it for me. So there's... I think that's kind of the hope of the gospel, is that there's this story being told, and that we haven't gotten to the end of the story yet, and that the end of the story will actually make the telling of the story very much worth the trouble. It seems to be the perspective of Paul and of Peter and the other gospel writers. So, but how does that kind of perspective sink into me in my life here and now, when those very natural questions that I was faced with early on in my Christian experience of what is this life going to look like? What is my hope for the future here? What do my decisions matter? Those are all really big, important questions, human questions. And I don't in any way mean to say that the gospel doesn't address those questions. I don't think it addresses them directly, though, in the way that I was thinking that it did. Rather, I think that there's all kinds of implications of really having a perspective that sees the end of the story from within the story that can give me hope in the midst of here and now, and can very much inform how I live and how I make my decisions here and what this life looks like. So I want to shift now a little bit to more talking about what does that look like in terms of our experience, and what do we find hopeful about having to wait this very long and sometimes very difficult life out for that end of the story that is very far off? I have a good friend who many years ago, about 15 years ago, was diagnosed with cancer, and she talks about her experience of that. We were talking fairly recently about her experience of that, and I was really struck by something that she said. She said that ever since, this is now, and the cancer was 15 years ago, saying, ever since I had cancer, it's like I'm living with one foot in the kingdom and one foot here. And what she was saying in that was that this experience that she had of having cancer was such a gift to her in such a way that was totally not what she expected from it when it happened. But one of the questions that it raised for her that really kind of pinned her to the wall in a way was that she had young children at the time, and she really had to wrestle with the idea that God could take her away from her young children, and that that could actually happen, and there was a real possibility of that. It was a really big struggle for her to know whether or not God was good if he did that. And so in the midst of really struggling with that, the way I think she would describe it is, I don't know that she would say when or how it happened or that she could really pinpoint it, but she came through that experience knowing in a much deeper, fuller way than she ever knew before that God is good. And he wasn't good because he wasn't going to take her away. He wasn't good because that wasn't going to happen. She didn't know at the time what was going to happen. But he was just good because he was good. And even if that was what he planned, she knew he was good and that they would be okay. So it was like she resigned herself in a way to this bigger picture from God, this bigger picture that she couldn't grasp or understand. And in the midst of that resignation, she died. She died to the idea of the future with her kids. And it was a really big deal. And yet, in the midst of dying in that way, she came to life. She says that in the midst of that, she came to understand how big God's goodness is, and therefore how fully she can embrace this life. And so in this very mysterious way, since she's had cancer, she said she is more alive than she ever has been. And she considers herself as living with one foot in each place very firmly, because she stared death right in the eyes in a way and faced, okay, that's what I'm waiting for, that's what I'm hoping for, and it's bigger than the pain of this circumstance right now. And in dying to that and coming back to life, she's also able to have a foot firmly planted here and enjoy her kids tremendously and work with her life and be fully alive in it. So I just think that that's an incredible picture of, and it seems to me that whatever the story is for each of us, it might not be something as dramatic as cancer, but it seems to me that we are asked to die over and over in this life in that same way, and that God takes us through experiences that wean us, if you will, from this world, that teach us to look more and more at what's ahead. And so I get clearer as I go through this life. I get clearer about what I'm waiting for and how that makes this worth it. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. That if I really get a picture of the promise and what's ahead, then anything I go through here is really very temporary. And that's not to say we aren't asked to die in some very brutal ways, but I think that the life that comes in the resignation and the acceptance and the understanding of who God is and his goodness is where we can live in hope here and now, because that's true. And it doesn't depend on our circumstances being okay. It depends on God who is there. I was talking to someone else recently who has struggled for a very, very long time with pretty severe depression and some difficulties. And this person was talking about how when they're depressed, there's nothing else. It's like that's all there is. And then this person also has these experiences of God every now and then where she really sees that God is good, and it's like God is love and God loves me. And when that's there, that's all that's there. There's no depression. There's no depression. But the trouble is that it's one or the other. It's never they don't know about it's like they don't know about each other, those two parts. And they were telling me recently that they just within the last month or so had an experience where all of a sudden it made sense that somehow or another they could be true at the same time. And that was this really huge moment of revelation for this person because of their experience being so cut off, the two things not being related to one another at all. And it was like she had this picture of God's love that is actually this way. It actually covers over the depression that is here. And it's still there. It's not that it's not there. But there was this kind of acceptance of this is this inside of this. And it doesn't take it away, but it gives it a perspective and a meaning and a hope of something bigger that is actually true, I think, about God. And I think that's how hope can be lived here in the midst of really difficult things. Keeping our eyes on the promise of God for the gospel and its fulfillment can be the bigger picture perspective for whatever it is here that we're going through in the smaller box. Just aware as I was doing all that hand gesturing that the people listening by tape are not going to have any idea what I'm talking about right there. But oh well. Hopefully something will come through. So I was also reading this weekend, I was reading Kierkegaard. Jack has talked recently about Kierkegaard a lot, and one of the things he's talked about, it's been a while now, I guess, but was this section in Kierkegaard that talks about the night of faith and the night of resignation. But what kind of? Well, let's see, I have it written down. Infinite resignation. I looked in the notes. The night of infinite resignation and the night of faith. And the night like a knight with armor. And I just was really moved by this section of Kierkegaard. I highly recommend it. He's saying, he talks about Abraham, and I was really struck by this. He says something like, all I can do with Abraham is just be astonished. And he starts talking about the sacrifice that Abraham made of Isaac. And he points out that when Abraham was going through that process, he didn't know the outcome. And I think that's something that we can really lose sight of, because we've known the end of the story before we ever heard the whole story, most likely. And we kind of have that record to go back to and say, this is what God was doing. But to really get a picture of Abraham in the moment of saying, okay, I'm going to sacrifice my son, is astonishing. I mean, it really is astonishing that he would make that choice not knowing the outcome, because he believed in such a way that he was seeing this big picture, who God is, faithful, good, next to this small picture of his sacrifice of Isaac. So anyway, Kierkegaard is talking about the night of faith as kind of a mythical character almost. He says he's not sure he's ever really met this person in the here and now, but he's contrasting the person who can be in this life in such a way that is resigned in a way, like my friend with her cancer, that is then able to enter back into life and be fully here. So this night of faith in Kierkegaard's writings is this person who he illustrates as a dancer who kind of has this perfect move, and it's a pirouette or something, and it's up in the air, but it's seamless. And then it's so seamless and pure that they're back on the ground before you know it. But there's touching the ground there too. It's not just the perfect move that's suspended in the air, but it's also down on the ground. And that both of those are true at the same time. And I was thinking about that in terms of my friend and her story with cancer, and picturing that it's that kind of dying to ourselves, I think, that he's talking about, where we, from there, are living again in hope, in the face of who God is. The night of infinite resignation, I think, is more so, I kind of had the picture that as opposed to my friend, the night of infinite resignation would be me going off to go be a missionary and saying, I'm going to give up everything and resign my life and do it all for God, and then staying there. And the way he describes it, it's like it's this infinite resignation, but it's actually this counterfeit of real faith, because it's saying, I'm going to give up so much, but it's a giving up that is kind of superficial. It's not that I wasn't actually giving up my stuff. That was a big deal to give it up. But it didn't have any legs to it yet. It didn't have any substance to it, in the sense that what we really end up giving up in this life is kind of all our hopes and dreams of what we think we ought to get or have or get to do in the face of God drawing us toward this kingdom and weaning us from this life and giving us a taste more and more and more for that next place where we're going. And that's where our hope is, in this mysterious way. So so in conclusion, I'm just kind of throwing out some stories here about what I think the hope actually is of the believer, and also in what ways it can be expressed in our lives. And I think it can be expressed in ways that are as unique as each one of us in our experiences, that God is in the process and is committed to us in such a way that each of our experiences is designed to deepen our faith and increase our hope in what's ahead. So I'll tell just one more story in conclusion. And I'm thinking also of closing a verse toward the end of that chapter in Romans 8, when Paul says, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who is against us? I think that is really this big love picture of God that is so incredibly hopeful. I have another friend who, we were taking a walk one day recently and bemoaning our aging bodies and talking about how difficult it is to get older and how much it hurts, you know, it just plain hurts. Bodies don't do what they used to do anymore. And she was saying to me, I wish I could remember exactly how she said it, but she said, I just see it more and more, Nancy, as letting go, as I have to let go of this body even, as I age, as I let go of this body, I'm letting go of this life. And it's being planted somewhere else as my heart rests there. And I think, what a metaphor we even have in aging. It's really helped me feel a little better about getting older, to be honest. Not that it still doesn't hurt, but what a picture that even our bodies are telling us that we have to let go of this life, because that's what's ahead and coming, and that's where real life is. So, another picture of hope. Open it up for your questions, thoughts, experiences.
I think it is, maybe I could pose the question in response to a lot of what you talked about tonight is about gaining a perspective on the next life. You also talked about the relevance of that belief and that hope for now. Mm-hmm. But if you're a 20-year-old something, How would you counsel someone to think about living life right now when your life is in front of you? You're just finishing your education, and you're getting your education, and you've got a career in front of you, and maybe finding a marriage partner and children, and all that stuff is in front of you. How do you respond to that? Where does hope fit in that paradigm?
I think that if we have a full perspective on what the gospel is promising, and I know that I don't think we can have a full perspective on very much. I don't think I have a full perspective on very much. I've got a lot of years ahead of me as well for it to get fuller and fuller, this perspective that I'm talking about. But I do think that this picture of embracing life here and now is really vivid, in the sense that this is where God has planted us. This is true, and this is where we're heading. And this life here is our journey to there. And I think there's tons of stuff we embrace in this life. The difference is that I can embrace it without having to have it satisfy me the same way it would have to satisfy me if I didn't know about this. So apart from this hope that's out there, I have to have the stuff I need here to make my life fulfilled. If I know about that hope and can really embrace that hope, then I can really embrace what's here, but I can embrace it in such a way that I can also let it go, because it isn't everything. It's actually, in one way, I think it can give us more courage to risk loving, for example, to risk really investing in this life, because I can give that and be stretched by it and be grown by it and be blessed by it here, yet holding it loosely and being able to let it go when God decides. Because I know that it's not everything. Does that make sense? I'm really glad you asked that, because I was thinking of asking a similar question to the audience, because there's quite a few guys in that category, and I am curious about, I'm not sure how I would have heard this talk 25 years ago for me. And I wonder what it sounds like to you guys, quite honestly. If it sounds like, yuck. or if it sounds like, okay. One of you back there is not kind of nodding, like, yeah, I think I get what you're saying. I don't know. But.
Okay. I'm 17 years old, so I have much life ahead of me. And I just want to say thank you, first of all, for talking about this issue of hope. I know I'm not alone. I'm not the only one in this room who struggles with depression also. And so the concept of hope is just very relevant to my life. And I completely understand what you were saying about your friend, that I've experienced that too. It's like, it's just like this cloud, and there's like nothing else. And like the concept of hope, it's like, that's just so weird and like something else, you know? And I think just listening to your talk, I completely agree with everything you say, and I was trying to imagine if one of my friends was sitting here who isn't a believer, like what they would be thinking. And because I've tried to explain, especially when I'm depressed, like try to explain the concept of hope that I have, and this hope in like this other life after this life. And a lot of people just say to me, but what about like now? I mean, you can't just like let go of everything. It's like, oh well, whatever, because when I die, I'll just have this great little life, but for now, do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, they don't understand how, like, what the purpose of living if I'm just thinking about what comes after life.
Right.
And I think what you just said in response to Wes is, I think therein lies the answer, that in this life, I'm thinking about the book Inside Out by Larry Crabb, which I know we've talked about before, in this life, that having that hope, that is where the life is found. And I think only with that hope, like you said, in our relationships can we really be loving. And I think that we can only really be loving because we don't like need other people to be something for us, because we know that the desires we have will be met just after we die. And so there's not this like quiet desperation of just needing to like get things from people and like selfishly just looking for ways to like satiate this hunger inside of you from
because
others.
Your life depends on it.
Yeah, as if your life depends on it, because it doesn't. Because we, like you said, you can just let go. And when people like sin against us and when we're victims of sin, it's okay, because that's this life. And there will be a life afterwards where that won't happen anymore. And we don't have to like seek revenge and become bitter. And so, I don't know. That's just my response to what you said.
I appreciate you.
Yeah.
Sharing that.
I really appreciate your talk, because from someone who's 21, like, it became clear to me at a very young age that life was really hard, and that I started to kind of dread it, because it was like, it seems like there's only bad things that happen, and they're just consecutively on top of each other, just one thing right after another. And it was kind of like, yay, so excited to grow up.
Welcome to life.
And the Bible always talked about a thing called joy, and it always was like, what was that? And it wasn't until I realized that we only have joy into context of having a hope in something beyond. And that gave me such hope for this life, because I was like, I can be joyful here because of what I have there. And that totally revolutionized my life and how I can take these trials. And I have found that even though I don't look forward to trials, I constantly look back to the things that have been harder in my life, and just it is coming through those things that have been the most joyful times in my life, and profoundly good. Such profound good has come out of that. And this kind of leads into one of my questions about, like, something I've always wondered about heaven is, it seems like we have some of our deepest joy through sorrow. So when it comes to heaven and there is to be no evil, like, I have a hard time, one, imagining that, and two, seeing that as, I don't know how to say this without sounding really weird, but seeing that as good. Like, if you think of a story with no bad guy, it's not much of a story, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you notice that, like, all the movies, the chick flicks, like, they have, like, this terrible trial, like, trying to figure out who likes who and get married. But as soon as they get married, like, the movie ends. It's like, no one wants to hear about that. It's like, they're all happy.
It doesn't seem like there's much of a story after that, is what you're saying.
Well,
even though we,
like,
know that's not true about marriage. But.
How, I guess, maybe what's your perspective on the fact that there's no evil in heaven, and yet it's not a boring place, I guess?
That's a great question. I think it's really hard for us to imagine that, because it's so foreign to our experience and to how we know ourselves and know our lives. But my sense is, from reading the scriptures and kind of trying to develop this picture that I think those authors had, there's this idea of glory that I think is so impeded by our evil, if you will, that that humans, in their purest, most fulfilled creation of being truly good. I loved a couple of weeks ago when Jack was talking about how it really is, even in life now, we have the experience of it being fulfilling when we do good things. It's like we're created to do good things. It fits for us because that's how God created us. And when I think about that part of us being unleashed in a way, I guess that's how I can imagine, or I can't imagine, quite honestly, but can maybe picture that it could be really glorious. It's like the Garden of Eden without being thrown out at the end, but also kind of with this kind of blooming where we're planted in such a profound way that our relationships flourish, that we engage in what's meaningful. Work even could be, work could be there, but it wouldn't be frustrating like it so often is now. Things that we enjoy creating, our creativity could flourish in a different way, where with music or art or poetry, I don't know. A book that that kind of planted that though for me was way back, C.S. Lewis, the Space Trilogy. You guys read Out of the Silent Planet and his picture of the planet Malacandra, I think it is. It's been a really long time since I read that book, but I remember these beasts that were there, kind of have this vague memory in this part of the book where these beasts who did this hunt every year or something, and this was a planet where there wasn't any sin or evil, so these three or four different kinds of creatures that lived there that were sentient beings that were like rational human type beings, but they were beasts, one of them was kind of this beast, and they would go on this hunt every year, and they had some of them die on the hunt, and they would have this funeral afterwards, and they would grieve the loss and go on, but the guy who was watching it noticed this really profound difference in how they were grieving, that they weren't really grieving the same way he would have expected them to grieve. And their answer to it was, well, because that's life. It's okay. It's what happens. And it wasn't devastating to them. It was understandable, and it was like they had this sense of trust in their creator who was managing all that. And they didn't have to worry about it, in a way. Even though it was, and they were very engaged in life. And I just think about those creatures, and maybe in response to what you're talking about, I don't know. It's hard to imagine.
I was thinking about that book too. What's implicit in that is that what Lewis is saying is there may not be evil, but that doesn't mean there's no danger. And it's really the danger and the obstacles that we have to overcome that creates the drama that Melanie was talking about. And so there's no reason to think that there won't be, that it won't be a factor times more exciting and dramatic than this life is. But like you say, but without that spoiler, evil and unrighteousness that affects things. Our concept of heaven that we usually have is very static. And that gets reinforced by things like in Revelation where you have angels standing around eternally saying, holy, holy, holy. It gets reinforced by that. But mostly our view of eternity as static, I think, comes not from the Bible but from Greek philosophy. Because the view of perfection there was, you know, Aristotle's view of God was the unmoved mover who is completely self-absorbed, thinking about himself, thinking. And it's because movement and change and drama and the structure of a moving story is imperfection in the Greek worldview, but not so in the biblical worldview. And so we just shouldn't think in those terms. There's every reason to think that the kingdom of God will be an adventure, a huge adventure.